From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Executions and elections. The Mexican government calls on George W. Bush to stop the execution of a Mexican national 2 days after the presidential election. We'll take a look at an issue politicians don't like to talk about, long-term environmental health, and environmental activist Terry Swearingen speaks out. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Just when President Alberto Fujimori of Peru appeared to be wresting control of Peru's military from his ex-spy chief, Vladimiro Montesinos, who's returned from Panama, and stabilizing weeks of political turmoil, a group of 51 soldiers staged a daring revolt demanding Fujimori resign and the shadowy spymaster be put behind bars. Fujimori held an emergency meeting at the government palace with the newly appointed army chief, and radio reports this morning say he left the meeting in a heavily armed caravan for a military airbase in a Lima port. The caravan was seen returning to the palace shortly afterward. The purpose of the trip was not immediately clear. Expressing disgust with Fujimori and the continued influence of his former intelligence chief, Vladimiro Montesinos, the insurrectionists seized a southern mine before dawn Sunday and then fled with 5 hostages. Israeli tanks and armored personnel carriers rolled into the Gaza Strip, exchanged fire with Palestinian gunmen yesterday as violent clashes continue in the occupied territories. Israeli troops shot and killed 5 Palestinians in the region, bringing the death toll in the month-long conflict to at least 140. Nearly all of the dead are Arabs and Palestinians. It's on to Wisconsin today for Al Gore, who's wrapping up a swing through key Midwest states. Gore spent yesterday in Michigan telling voters they have the ability to decide what's going to be a close election. George W. Bush is launching a Western campaign swing on the theme of bringing America together. Meanwhile, joined by rock stars and flanked by signs proclaiming Remember the Supreme Court, a group of advocates of the environment, gay rights, and abortion rights activists today kicked off a 5-state tour aimed at people thinking of voting for Ralph Nader. Their message, don't do it. Vote for Al Gore. And Planned Parenthood will begin airing a $2 million last-minute pro-Gore push campaign, advertising trying to thwart the Green Party nominee's White House bid. The targeting of states is happening in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Oregon, states that have caused ripples of fear in the Democratic Party. The new Planned Parenthood commercials will target those areas and New Mexico, where a Green Party candidate won a House seat in the last campaign. And this news from Yugoslavia in Pristina. Unofficial results show the party of a moderate ethnic Albanian leader topping another led by a former anti-Serbian guerrilla fighter in municipal Kosovo elections that are seen as a popularity test for 2 rivals with a common goal, independence from Yugoslavia. In a statement from his office, new Yugoslav president Vojislav Kostunica yesterday called the elections invalid since the Serb minority in the province boycotted the vote. Serbs in Kosovo are believed to number only in the tens of thousands. Many have been driven out since the NATO bombing. And this news from Tanzania, furious over irregularities. Opposition leaders today called for new elections, the resignation of the Zanzibari government, and the dismissal of its electoral commission as protests grew on the semi-autonomous Indian Ocean archipelago. Riot police fired live rounds of ammunition today at some 300 stone-throwing followers of the opposition Civic United Front. They were protesting the failure of the Zanzibar Electoral Commission to deliver ballots to 16 of the districts where the party was expected to do well in the country's second multi-party elections held on Sunday. And this news from Kyrgyzstan, its president won easy re-election in the Central Asian nation. According to preliminary results today, Askar Kayev won almost three-quarters of the vote. This according to the Electoral Commission. Ballots from 15 polling stations in remote mountain villages had to be counted.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground. Won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground.
Johnny Cash here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And speaking of Cash, I want to thank all of the listeners from Pacifica stations and affiliates who have been pledging their support during this latest round of fundraising drives. That song, Solitary Man. I'm Amy Goodman as we start off today with the issue of executions and elections. Ray Bonner has a piece in today's New York Times which says, reflecting an increasing intervention by foreign governments in American death penalty cases, Mexico has sent a formal protest to the U.S. State Department in an effort to prevent the execution of a Mexican citizen scheduled to be put to death in 2 weeks, 2 days after the presidential election. The Mexican government has said that the condemned man, Miguel Angel Flores, was deprived of due process because he was not advised of his right to contact the Mexican embassy in violation of an international treaty. We're joined right now by three people who will be participating in a news conference today in Austin. Mike Warren is with us. He is a human rights activist and a specialist on foreign nationals on death rows in the United States. Sandra Babcock also joins us, one of the lawyers for the condemned man. And we're joined on the telephone from Austin by a representative of the Mexican consulate here in the United States, Gilberto Villardi. Let's begin with Sandra Babcock. Can you explain why Miguel Angel Flores is on death row right now in Huntsville, Texas?
Let me just correct you on one point. I'm actually not Mr. Flores' attorney. I'm an attorney representing the government of Mexico in the case. But, of course, we're all working very closely with Mr. Flores' attorneys. Mr. Flores is on death row right now. He was convicted in 1980. And at the time he was convicted, this is a man with an IQ of 85 who grew up in a Spanish-speaking community in West Texas. He was never informed that he had the right to contact the Mexican consulate, which is his right under an international treaty signed and ratified by the United States for 30 years ago. He was never informed until, in fact, I don't believe he was ever informed. The Mexican consulate found out he was already on death row after his trial, after his death sentence, at a time when it was absolutely powerless to affect what had happened to him. He was represented by a lawyer who did virtually nothing to defend him at the sentencing phase of his trial, and the jury convicted him based on the testimony of a psychiatrist who had never before even met him. This is something that you've heard probably the courts refer to now as junk science, and that's what his death sentence was based on.
Mr. Flores was 20 at the time of the crime. He had no criminal record or history of violence. His court-appointed lawyer did not speak Spanish, put on no character witnesses or mitigating evidence. Gilberto Villardi, the Mexican government wants Mr. Flores' sentence commuted to life in prison. What has been the State Department's response?
Yes?
What has been the U.S. State Department's response?
Okay, I am waiting for a good answer about our solicitation, because the Mexican government is concerned about the observance of the Article 36 of the Vienna Convention. When we have the notification from the authorities about the apprehension of some Mexican, we have the opportunity to speak with him and to notify his Miranda right. And especially in this case of Flores case, we can see that the due process was violated, because he has an ineffective support of his counsel, and we can't monitorizing the activity of the counsel in any case of the Mexican is involved. And really, we are concerned, because we are talking about international treaty like the Vienna Convention, and we show to observe in general the content of the international law.
In the last 2.5 years, 6 states have executed a foreign citizen. Next month there's going to be a landmark case in which Germany is suing the United States in the World Court, seeking reparations for the execution in Arizona last year of 2 brothers, Carl and Walter Legrand. They weren't advised of their consular rights, according to Arizona officials, who acknowledged this many years after the brothers' incarceration, only the 4th time in nearly half a century that an ally has sued the U.S. in the international court. And if the court rules for Germany, other countries are likely to sue. Let's bring Mark Warren into the conversation. You are a human rights activist, and you particularly look at the case of foreign nationals on death rows in this country. Can you talk about this trend as well as other examples and how Mr. Flores fits into this?
Yes, Amy. I think it's important to begin by understanding the scope of the problem. There are at present at least 90 foreign citizens on death row across the United States, representing 30 different nationalities. So this is neither an isolated problem nor one that concerns just one or two governments. The United States, when it ratified the Vienna Convention, which is the international treaty that we're talking about, it's a treaty that covers consular rights and duties around the world, but it also includes very important safeguards to protect all detained foreigners, including Americans abroad. When the U.S. ratified that treaty, it also ratified a dispute settlement mechanism whereby a country that feels that its treaty rights have been violated or those of its nationals can go to the world's highest court and seek and possibly obtain a remedy. Germany is also a party to that treaty, and following the execution of the Legrand brothers, Germany announced that it intended to continue with its action. It had initially sought a kind of injunction from the international court that would have required the U.S. to stay the execution so that this case could be properly heard, and so that the international court would be able to determine how this treaty should be applied and what remedies would be available. But that order from the international court was ignored by U.S. authorities, and that so angered the German authorities that they've now decided to proceed with their case. And in a matter of about a week, the international court, for the first time in its history, will be hearing arguments on the application of an international treaty as it applies to the use of the death penalty. This is, of course, a landmark decision. It has very significant implications, not only, of course, for Germany, but for many other countries. And I think it reflects a growing international concern over what is perceived as a kind of double standard by the United States, a country that portrays itself as a human rights champion around the world, which vigorously intervenes whenever an American is deprived of their consular rights abroad. But when the same violation occurs at home, all we hear from the State Department is that the individual has no legal right to consular assistance and that the only remedy available is a posthumous apology.
Sandra Babcock, you live in Minneapolis. You're an attorney there. You've gotten, a $300,000 grant to set up a project to provide legal assistance to Mexican citizens on death row in this country. What has been the response of George W. Bush in particular? This execution of Miguel Angel Flores is scheduled for 2 days after the election. Do you think that there's a reason for that?
Well, I don't know. We do know that the state attorney general had some influence over when this execution date was set. And I'm certain that the governor's office is also acutely aware of how sensitive an issue this is with the Mexican government. The foreign advisor to the incoming president of Mexico today was quoted in the Times as saying that this is an issue that strains bilateral relations with Mexico. And Mexico, of course, is a very important trading partner with the United States. And we have a host of very important and delicate issues that the United States deals with Mexico on a daily basis. So I don't know whether or not the governor's office had anything to do with the setting of this date, but I'm sure they're aware of it. In fact, we are going to meet with them today at 2 o'clock to discuss Mr. Flores' case and to ask the governor to exercise his power to grant a temporary reprieve and to order the Board of Pardons and Paroles to investigate this case and to convene a hearing, which he has the power to do. He doesn't often admit that publicly, but he does have the power by statute to order an investigation of the case. So that's what we're asking. We think that this case deserves more than 15 minutes of anyone's time in deciding whether or not a person should live or die. We also believe that the jury didn't adequately consider all of the factors that made Miguel Angel Flores a unique human being, flawed and vulnerable to be sure, but someone who didn't deserve to be put to death.
Now, he was found guilty of the 1989 rape and murder of a 20-year-old video store employee in Hutchinson County in the Texas Panhandle. Why would it matter if his family members were involved in this case? One of the points that's raised by the Mexican government is that families of Mexican defendants who live in villages in Mexico are poor, don't have travel documents, are frightened by the prospect of coming to the United States. What difference would it have made in Flores' case?
Well, the only way that prosecutors are able to convince juries to sentence people to death is by dehumanizing them. And it's obviously much easier to do that when the person sitting in front of the jury has darker skin, someone who doesn't come from their community, speaks a foreign language, and particularly when his lawyer doesn't put on any witnesses to tell the jury, this is my son, this is my brother, he may have committed a terrible deed. You may not understand why he committed that terrible deed, but I'm telling you that he's never done anything like this before, that he is a human being, that he does have a very low IQ, that he's somebody who was subjected to this form of abuse or that form of pressure, or this is to give the jury some form of mitigating explanation for what happened and who he is. In the absence of that, the jury really doesn't have any other choice but to sentence him to death, and they did that in this case based on the testimony of a psychiatrist who had never before examined him.
Mark Warren, if people want to get involved in this case at this late hour, what can they do?
Oh, I think there are many ways that people can get involved even now. One of the initiatives, of course, that is ongoing is a request to the State Department to intervene actively in the case. People can certainly contact either their own federal representatives or directly contact the State Department. They can email or call the State Department and ask that the United States live up to its international commitments and show real leadership, because this really is a bipartisan issue. It's more than just what the governor of Texas will do or not do. It's about the United States' reputation and credibility in the world. And we're hopeful still that the State Department will join us in calling for a full and fair clemency process, because we're absolutely convinced that if the members of the Board of Pardons could hear all of the testimony about this young man that the jury never did hear, that they will, too, be moved to show some mercy.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Mark Warren, human rights activist specialized in foreign nationals on death row here. Sandra Babcock, a Minneapolis attorney who has represented prisoners on death row in Texas. They are now representing the Mexican government in the case of Miguel Angel Flores. And Gilberto Villardi, who is with the Mexican consulate today. They're holding a news conference in Austin, Texas. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're taking on campaign issues that may not be addressed in the way that longtime environmental activists talk about them. So we're going to hear the activists speak. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we go now to Michael Lerner, not the Michael Lerner of Tycoon Magazine, but the founder of a growing group in this country called Healthcare Without Harm, also author of the book Choices in Healing, and a part of Commonweal, which is a health group in Bolinas, California. He spoke last weekend at the Bioneers Conference in Marin County, California, talking about the new emerging environmental medicine and health movement.
We started 4 years ago at Commonweal with 30 citizen activists and scientists and health-affected people who decided that of all the different forms of contamination that we're witnessing, that somehow the fact that hospitals were a leading source of dioxin and mercury exposure for the American people just didn't make a lot of sense to us. And 4 years later, Healthcare Without Harm has grown from 30 people to just about 300 organizations in 30 countries around the world. It has closed down hundreds of medical waste incinerators worldwide and prevented the placement of hundreds more in poor communities. It is leading to the ban or the phase out of mercury thermometers in the United States and around the world. And the mercury thermometer is interesting because although healthcare only accounts for a relatively small amount of the total mercury exposure, I think it's 5 or 10% of the American mercury exposure, nonetheless, everybody has that mercury thermometer in their bathroom. And the act of asking yourself, well, how do I dispose of this mercury thermometer, and do I realize this mercury can contaminate a 20-acre lake? And how do I dispose of it, and I'll get a digital thermometer in place of it? And then realizing that, of course, our coal plants and other major sources of mercury need really serious attention. It's one of those changing acts to decide that it's time to replace that mercury thermometer, like the decision to eat organic food. It's the same kind of thing. So Healthcare Without Harm and the Commonweal Cancer Help Program have been the two really transformative experiences of the last 10 or 15 years for me. The Cancer Help Program is about what we learn about personal healing. And for, as I say, 96 weeks, I've lived with people with cancer at Commonweal, small groups that are there doing yoga and meditation and imagery and group support, eating a vegetarian diet, receiving massage. Most of them are women. Most of them are women with breast cancer. Many of them are young women with metastatic breast cancer and small children. I want to tell you the story of one of these young women. She came on a cancer help program not long ago. She was 32 years old. She was married to a carpenter. She had a three-year-old son and an 18-month-old daughter. And she had metastatic breast cancer, and it was moving very rapidly. And one of the evenings, Wednesday evening, we talk about death and dying and how to die as well as possible when that time comes. And usually it's a very liberating evening for people to recognize that there's a lot that one can do to die well. There are a lot of choices. And in the face of the anxiety and fear that people often bring into the program, the evening on death and dying is often liberating for people. This young woman sat through the evening listening, taking some notes, and at the end of the evening, as other people got up and began to move around to get tea or coffee, she sat in her chair, and I noticed that she had begun to sort of shake and spasm. And I walked over to her with Yanni Chapman, who's our lead massage person on the program. And as we got closer to her, I thought she was having an epileptic seizure of some kind, so we both instinctively began to hold her. I was holding her shoulders and Yanni was holding her legs. And then I began to realize this wasn't an epileptic seizure. This was the totality of sadness and despair that this young woman was carrying. That no matter what we said about how you could die well, that the fact that in her early 30s with two very young children she was going to have to die of breast cancer was just too overwhelming to take. So we sat with her and we held her as she went through these spasms into sobbing, and finally it diminished. And I just, for me, she is a very vivid reminder that no matter how well we learn to die, no matter how spiritual we all are, whatever that means, and it means a lot, that we're living in an epidemic of breast cancer. And it's not only breast cancer, it's many other forms of cancer. And it's not only cancer, it's learning disabilities and behavior disorders and endometriosis and infertility and a wide, wide range of different chronic health problems that are related to chemical exposures and other environmental realities. And I think what we need, and I believe this community is so far ahead that it's almost irrelevant for me to say these words to you, but somehow I simply want to feed back into our collective consciousness what we're talking about here. There is a new analysis emerging among us. And that analysis, I believe, is that we are living in an age of extinctions and we are witnessing an emerging environmental health movement that is a great source of hope in the face of the totality of what we are doing to the earth. We're living in an age of extinctions in which the scientists are very clear that we are driving biodiversity, which is the sacred tree of life, back 65 million years to its lowest level of vitality since the end of the age of dinosaurs. And this age of extinctions is the fifth great spasm of extinctions in the history of the earth, and it's being caused by human beings. And there are four great drivers of this age of extinction. We know this also: climate change, ozone depletion, toxic chemicals, and habitat destruction. And we could speak at length of each. We could speak of climate change, droughts, floods, hurricanes, crop failures, melting polar ice caps, tens of millions of environmental refugees, island nations facing submersion. We could talk about ozone depletion, how the ozone hole is larger each year, the rising rates of malignant melanoma around the world, depleted immune systems as a result of radiation exposure. We could talk about habitat destruction, how the forests, which are the lungs of the earth, are being destroyed, and how in being destroyed you have viruses leap from species to species in these disrupted habitats like HIV and other extant and potential modern plagues. But I'm going to focus a little more on chemicals, because this is one that we have a very intimate relationship with, since these chemicals are in our bodies. There's a very great book by Theo Colburn and Pete Myers and Diane Dumanowski called Our Stolen Future, which is the kind of Bible that has spawned a whole new literature on endocrine disrupting chemicals. And the difference between the capacity of chemicals to cause cancer and endocrine disruption is that endocrine disruption is something that happens to the developing fetus in the womb. And the fetus in the womb is exquisitely vulnerable to these chemicals, which mimic the signals that the mother's endocrine system sends to the fetus to guide its development. And at infinitely lower levels than chemicals cause cancer, at parts per billion or parts per trillion, These chemicals can shape the development of the developing fetus and cause a wide array of impacts on health, fertility, and intelligence. And the simple truth is that we are now all holding in our bodies body burdens of these chemicals, which are comparable to those at which we see demonstrable health effects in wildlife and in laboratory animals. And the results are growing linkages, not easy to make, but growing linkages of increasing strength with breast cancer, testicular cancer, learning disabilities, behavior disorders, endometriosis, infertility, precocious puberty, shifting sex ratios, neurological conditions. In animals research, we see that there are changes in gender orientation in wildlife around the Great Lakes. In Florida, the alligators with the famous micropenises as a result of chemical exposures. The polar bears, 1% of polar bears on an island in the Arctic have dual sex organs as a result of these chemical exposures. The list goes on. In babies of mothers who eat a lot of Great Lakes fish with chemical loads, they startle easily, they're hard to console, they have learning and behavior disorders in school. I went to Pete Meyer's website, www.ourstolenfuture.org, and looked last night just at a few of the recent studies. It's a very interesting thing to do from time to time. A new assessment shows that confirms sperm counts declining in the industrial countries around the world. Another study, two ubiquitous endocrine disruptors, DDT and HCH, have estrogenic impacts on mice at concentrations comparable to those in many people. A study by the Learning Disabilities Association, Polluting Our Future, that the chemical pollutants that affect child development in learning in the United States, 24 billion pounds of developmental toxicants are released in the United States annually, and 17% of kids have developmental learning or behavior disorders. A study from the Centers for Disease Control, this is a particularly interesting one to me, in women of childbearing age, the endocrine-disrupting chemicals called phthalates, you'll hear more and more about phthalates in the coming year, particularly monoethyl phthalate and monobutyl phthalate, are very high in women of childbearing age, and they probably come from exposure in hairsprays, nail polishes, and perfumes. Very, very interesting work. A report from the BBC, I just mentioned that, the 1% of polar bears are hermaphroditic on this island in the Arctic. An August report that girls in Puerto Rico with early breast development have 7 times the higher levels of the phthalate DEHP in their blood than girls with normal breast development. A July report that brominated fume retardants, which interfere drastically with thyroid function and can drastically affect mental competency, are being found in breast milk. And so on and so forth. A July report that low levels of dioxin, which of course comes when you burn PVC plastics in medical waste, interfere with vaginal development in rats. A report that children born to women with early puberty, remember we just linked that to chemicals, are more likely to develop asthma and allergies. So these reports just go on and on and on. And I want to give you one image which to me sort of encapsulates all these reports, and it's an image which is a tragic one to me, and I'm sorry to say it to you, but it's important to say it because it is the kind of thing that I believe mobilizes it. It is the truth that human breast milk has become one of the most toxic human foods. And that truth is a simple sort of algorithm, which is that the higher you live and eat on the food chain, the more toxics you bioconcentrate. These things go up 50 or 100-fold with every step up on the food chain. Well, humans live near the top of the food chain, but babies drinking breast milk are one level higher on the food chain. And in fact, the only way that is known for a human being to download a bunch of toxic chemicals is to get pregnant and breastfeed your first baby, because a mother's level of persistent organic pollutants declines very significantly when she gives them to her baby, who then carries that as part of its lifetime load of body burden. Well, I don't know about you all, but this is no longer okay for me, you know? That's the point at which You know, when I think of that young mother dying of premature breast cancer, when I think of the fact that, as Andrea Martin puts it, that the breasts of women have become toxic waste dumps, it's just not okay anymore. You know, I can tell you, I need to tell you, that breast milk is still the best food for babies, that in spite of the toxic chemicals, that the kids fed breast milk do better. They do better than the kids fed formula because the main damage has been done in the womb, in fetal development, and the positive benefits of breastfeeding still far outweigh those of feeding formula. But it's not okay that we are putting women, that we are putting all of us in this situation where we have to make choices of that kind. So what do we do about this? And I think it's very important not to see this as hopeless. And I think that Bioneers is a community that recognizes that it's not hopeless. You know, I love the quote from Václav Havel, the great Czech statesman and playwright, who distinguished between optimism and hope. Optimism, he said, is the belief that everything is going to go right. But hope is very different. Hope, he said, is a deep orientation of the human soul that can be held in the darkest of times. Now, these are, I mean, on the one hand, these are affluent times. But on the other hand, these are dark times for life on Earth. And if we ask ourselves where we can find true hope, I find it looking back over the last few hundred years of human history. I ask myself, what was it like for the early activists who were trying to replace monarchies with democracies? What was it like for the early Quakers who thought they might end slavery? What was it like for Florence Nightingale and all those in the 19th century who literally transformed the world when they began to understand that infectious disease vectors could be changed by public health measures, which is a very important example of what we're going to need to do. And in our own time, we've seen the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the peace movement, the environmental movement, the women's rights movement, the anti-apartheid movement, the gay rights movement. We could all go on. These collective shifts in consciousness are very, very important. A friend of mine at the Healthcare Without Harm conference that's going on at Commonweal right now was in Boston a week or so ago with the Ralph Nader rally at Boston Garden. And there were 12,000 people at this rally. And what amazed him most as he looked around him, he's in his 50s also, was that he recognized that well over the half of the people in that room were young. They were young. And you know, for those of us who grew up in the 60s, it's been kind of a lonely path here for a while. And to see these thousands and tens of thousands of young people coming together in an analysis that is really holding the balance in this presidential election almost, an analysis that we can no longer be silent about corporate power and responsibility, and that we can no longer be silent about simply the realities that we are facing. There is an awareness in a significant percent of the population. You know, they say, you know, NATO only may get 3 or 5 or 6% of the vote, but, you know, 5% of the people is critical mass in terms of turning things around. That's not a trivial amount. It not only... And it wasn't just true in Boston. It's been true across the country where Nader speaks. And it isn't only where Nader speaks. It was true in Seattle. You know, it has been true everywhere where people are protesting globalization, that it's not just 60s folks there. There is a whole new generation of activists. And I really believe that is one of the most profoundly hopeful things that we have seen. I want to speak for a moment about Healthcare Without Harm, because not only has it gone from 30 people to 300 organizations in 30 countries over the last 4 years, but more than that, it is a model of a new kind of very smart, grassroots-based, market-focused campaign that isn't focused so much on changing government regulations, but on changing corporate behavior in the marketplace. And the way it works is you create very, very wide coalitions. You focus on a single narrow point that everybody agrees on, like dioxin and mercury shouldn't be coming out of hospitals. And then you have the capacity, because hospitals, like other corporations, want to have a good name. They want their brand name to be okay. You have a capacity to work with these corporations to say, gee, wouldn't you like to make this little change, which you can make, and we can show you the way, instead of having this very wide group, not only of environmentalists, but labor, faith-based groups, health-affected groups, and so on, all concerned with your behavior. And these market-focused campaigns are changing the face of activism across the world. Internet-based, market-focused, grassroots, wide coalitions. And it's not only happening in healthcare, it's happening in the building industry with green buildings, in the car industry, in computers, in schools, in sustainable agriculture, in military toxics. So what we're doing is sector by sector, organizing these innovative toxic campaigns that focus on changing corporate behavior in the marketplace. And again, like the Nader phenomenon, it is a very hopeful sign. So I'd like to suggest, and this is not news to any of you, but a whole new analytic synthesis is coalescing around issues of globalization, human rights, women's rights, the environment, corporate power and accountability, environmental justice, the unfinished agenda of race, the responsibilities of faith communities in these biblical times, the question of who owns science. Toxicology is owned by the chemical corporations, and we can't have science owned by corporations. Dana Meadows says that for democracies to function, we need feedback loops. So science tells us the truth, the media feed it back to us, and democracies respond. Well, if science is owned by the corporations and the media are owned by the corporations, we're not getting the feedback loops that we need, except through the internet and the bioneers and things like that. We have to turn that around. Democracy is not real unless we turn that around. So I would like to capture this sense of what's taking place in this new analytic synthesis in a single phrase, that of the great Buddhist educator and peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh, who said that we need to move from an age of extinctions, he didn't say that, but to an age of what he calls interbeing, an age of awareness that life is truly one, and that medical waste incinerators in the United States are poisoning the Inuit people in the Arctic Circle, and that the body burdens of chemicals that every single baby around the world is born with and that is in the breast milk of every mother, that we are all one. And we are one with the dolphins and whales and seals that are carrying this. And the oneness of life is being brought back to us with a power and a literalness that we can no longer escape. And that awareness of interbeing is what is fueling this emerging environmental health movement, which we are seeing all around us. I believe that we are the ones who are destined to do this work. We really just don't have any choice.
And you've been listening to Michael Lerner of Healthcare Without Harm in California at the Bioneers Conference. Next up, Terry Swearingen after this break here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Terry Swearingen, she is an environmental activist who got her start, about 18 years ago, when the largest waste incinerator in this country, toxic waste incinerator, was placed in her community in Ohio called the WTI. She founded the Tri-State Environmental Council, which deals with incinerators in Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania, has been arrested 9 times for performing civil disobedience for the closing of the WTI, including on the steps of the White House. Terry Swearingen was speaking at the Bioneers Conference in California last week.
We're going to come down a notch. We're going to talk at the grassroots level. I have one correction to Nina's introduction, which was awesome. I was arrested inside of the White House. Thank you for this privilege to speak to you today. It truly is an honor. As she said, my name is Terry Swearingen. I am a registered nurse, but my most important credential is that I'm a mother. Although I'm not a scientist and I don't have a PhD, I do have a few letters following my name. Could I have the first overhead? Could I have the first overhead, please? I don't know where I'm, who I'm talking to. You see the letters after my name, NMBS? Those are my credentials. No more bullshit. As Nina said, I live with my family in the Ohio River Valley, where I've been involved in an effort to stop one of the world's largest commercial toxic waste incinerators. It's located in the floodplain, immediately on the bank of the Ohio River, in an impoverished minority Appalachian River town. It's in a residential area where the closest home is only 320 feet away. WTI's smokestack is level with the front doors and windows of a 400-student elementary school that sits on a bluff above the site, 1,100 feet away. While we haven't stopped WTI yet, we have been successful. Our efforts have halted other commercial incinerators from being built around the country. Because of our efforts, Ohio enacted a moratorium on the construction of new hazardous waste incinerators across the state. We motivated Congress to conduct its first ever hearings to look at the ways EPA bent the rules to help the industries they're supposed to regulate. We prompted a nationwide freeze on construction of new toxic waste incinerators and forced an overhaul of federal combustion regulations, including the development of more stringent emissions limits for toxic heavy metals and a first-time emission limit for dioxin under RCRA. We compelled the federal government, thank you, to acknowledge the serious risk that pollution poses to our food chain. And more recently, citizens working to stop WTI have been credited as being the driving force behind EPA's action to implement national siting standards for hazardous waste management facilities. I'd like to share with you some of the strategies we use to achieve these successes and offer a vision for the future to prevent the continued poisoning of the planet. I first learned about WTI in 1982. What caught my attention was that WTI was legally allowed to release 4.7 tons of lead into the air annually. Lead is a poison that is particularly harmful to the fragile developing brains and nervous systems of children. Any lead released into the environment is cause for concern, but when you consider that it will be raining down on children next door, that's criminal. In 1984, Ohio passed a law prohibiting the construction of any hazardous waste management facility within 2,000 feet of any home, school, hospital, prison, or within the floodplain. WTI was not built until 7 years after that law was enacted in 1991. A congressional hearing on WTI was held in May of 92, and two major problems were identified. One, the WTI site so close to homes and an elementary school poses an undue risk to an impoverished minority community, and two, WTI's permits are invalid and rules were not followed. Top EPA officials admitted before Congress that they'd violated their own laws in issuing the permit, but they allowed its continued operation. We've learned that the agency set up to protect public health and the environment only do so if it's non-threatening to any corporation. The dynamics we're seeing in the environmental movement across the country are, one, the government versus the people, two, multinationals versus the planet, and three, consultants versus common sense. People don't want these dangerous facilities, but the government does. Who's driving this process? Multinational corporations who generate too much waste and the multinational waste companies who want to profit from it. How did they get away with it? Consultants versus common sense. With WTI, we're looking at the machinery of government directed against the people, not in the interest of the people. We're looking at multinational corporation against the interests of a planet. They're only interested in profit. And finally, how did they get away with it? Incredibly highly paid consultatutes versus common sense. He did it already. WTI is about this. You notice there are only, there's a 50 in there. That's all I could find, the biggest bill. We show off the Statue of Liberty and talk about America as the greatest country in the world, but this is what it's all about, money. WTI is an issue of putting American children at risk in violation of the law to promote the financial interests of the money men behind the project. Money can make black, white, round, flat, dioxin safe enough to eat on your cornflakes, and having an incinerator 1,100 feet from an elementary school is perfectly safe. It can buy politicians, regulators, presidents, and lawyers. But it isn't just a few people at the top who want to corrupt the system. Evil doesn't occur because of one monstrous personality like Hitler. One or two evil people can only corrupt a system when they get the acquiescence of hundreds of smaller, faceless players helping to carry out the agenda. Evil happens when good people rationalize fudging the truth. We must hold them accountable. Not only those at the top demanding the corruption, but all those who carry out the agenda. And we can't fall into the trap of naming faceless bureaucracies. We must name names. Anytime any elected official, regulatory agent, or industry employee is responsible for a decision that allows the poisoning of our children, we should put his picture on a poster detailing his dirty work and distribute it everywhere so y'all know who did it. The WTI case is a story about our society. There's been a fundamental breakdown in democracy and the system of accountability. It's one thing to struggle and fight to protect the health and welfare of our children, but to then experience that our own government is subverting our democratic system, providing ways for the corporations or the money men to get around the law, that's shocking. We need to recapture America from the corporate interests that run our government. If we don't demand accountability, we're going to lose our democracy. It took a decade for us to learn that working within the system didn't benefit the people. We pursued legal, political, and economic strategies in trying to protect our children with little effect. That's when we engaged in a direct action campaign, which included peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience. We broke the law to stop our government from breaking the law. We broke the law because we found the state of Ohio breaking their own law, which was meant to protect citizens with a 2,000-foot buffer zone around dangerous facilities. When our own government was not obeying the law, we had to break the law to draw their attention to the injustice. As Nina said, I've been arrested 9 times, and I've spent many days in jail, including in Washington, D.C. Our first act of civil disobedience resulted in arrest in 1991. Following a rally attended by about 1,500 citizens, 33 citizens, including actor Martin Sheen, climbed the fence around WTI. Of course, we were arrested and thrown in jail, but I have to tell you, it felt so good to go over that fence. To know that I was upholding a higher law, that I was working to protect our children, I was trying to uphold the law of human decency. I crossed the line because they crossed the line, from a trust in people and democracy to a worship of technocracy and money. I crossed the line because they crossed the line between human exploitation and human values. Number 3, a week later, we traveled 3.5 hours to the Ohio State Capitol dressed in striped prison garb. And number 4, to issue wanted posters for the real criminal. I don't know if you can read. Can you read the fine print? Yeah, it's just you know what, I can't even read it from here. But anyway, at the very bottom it says, do not try to, it's about the governor of Ohio, and it says, eyes blind to the fact, ears deaf to the, you know, calls of the citizens. But then at the very bottom it says, if you see this man, do not try to comprehend alone. When Governor Voinovich refused repeated attempts to meet with us and continued instead to defend WTI, we went to his mansion and posted for sale signs on his lawn. We arrived at his home 30 minutes earlier than expected, catching him at home. As he jumped into a waiting car, we asked to speak with him, and his response was, I have nothing to say. When reporters asked for comments without thinking, I just blurted out, well, he's a weenie. He lacks the guts to face his constituents. To my embarrassment, the quote not only appeared in the next day's paper, but they actually highlighted it really big. So we decided to have fun with that. We used the hot dog to symbolize Governor Voinovich was a weenie on waste. We held a weenie roast right in front of his mansion. And I got to be the weenie governor. I dressed in a hot dog costume with the mask of the governor. And I don't remember the exact words of my little presentation, but it went something like this. Frankly, I don't relish the pickle I'm in. I need to muster the courage to catch up with front-end solutions. I feel like a weenie squeezed between a bun. It's no picnic being in this position. I think I'm going to get roasted. We got a lot of media attention. We got our message out, and we had fun doing it. We kept up the weenie campaign for about a year. In fact, we never went to Columbus without delivering the governor a hot dog from the vendors outside. We had pressure-sensitive stickers made with the governor's phone number on a picture of a hot dog that said, if you think the governor's a weenie on waste, call him. We went into all the grocery stores in Columbus, and we put these stickers on all the packages of buns and hot dogs. But one of the funniest weenie actions happened by accident. We heard that the governor was about to hold a press conference to announce his, get this, opposition to a toxic labeling law that would have required labels on products that cause birth defects or cancer. He was opposing it. So we hid foot-long hot dogs under our coats and entered the press conference. I'm number five. When the governor took the podium, we pulled out our foot-long hot dogs and silently waved them in the air. The next day, newspaper headlines were hysterical. Weenie-wielding women whack Voinovich on waste.
Terry Swearingen speaking at the Bioneers Conference last weekend in Marin County, California. That does it for today's program. Special thanks to Janice K. Bryant. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!